We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is hour two of our show, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson, and Jason Croft is at the controls right now. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. Well, one thing that we certainly know is that the world is becoming increasingly globalized, and that is indeed something that business has been coming to grips with for some time. It is true also that more and more people in higher education are working to do the same. And we'll try to talk a little bit about that this morning in this hour of the show as we talk with Maresi Narad. She is the director of the Center for Innovation and Research in Graduate Education at the University of Washington. And she is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in the Symposium on Graduate Education for 2011, Global Experiences and International Engagement. And in fact, she will be giving talk on the campus tomorrow afternoon, 1 o'clock, at the Illini Union, talking about some of these very issues. And she's been good enough to come and spend a little time talking with us about this whole business of getting graduate students ready to address the challenges of an increasingly globalized world. And that is what we'll be talking about here in this hour of the show. Questions from people who are listening certainly are welcome. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455 is the number for anybody if it would be a long-distance call. So use that and we'll pay for the call. And also, if you'd like to send a question on to us by email, you may do that too. Will-talk is the address. That's like it sounds, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Maybe as a general, as a way to start in very generally, I could ask a question like how has globalization affected the whole business of graduate education, particularly when we're talking about the level of PhDs?
It has affected in many ways. And we have there, I have to go a bit further and say what has happened around the world, that governments, economic theories have circulated around the world, and those say the following, that if we have innovations, it's often coupled with economic growth. So governments have bought into those economic theories, and they're trying to look around how can we get a labor force and country to be innovative. And so the looking of people also have new novel ideas. So that's why it often comes also to doctoral education. Mm-hmm. And so therefore many countries around the world have invested again for, I wouldn't say the first time, but lately, into higher education and particularly doctoral education, more than it's done in the U.S. Mm. So what you then have seen is that countries around, and there are various reasons for it. You have countries, or you see also an interest in internationalization, which I define as the activities higher education and universities and college do, while globalization is a phenomenon which doesn't have like a particular actor, but many, and it's very much the economic driver, how ideas, culture, products circulate around the world and have an impact on economics, labor markets, so also in higher education. Now, we have around the world different countries who are in various situations. Take the European countries, specifically the Northern and Central European countries, and also Japan, we have to put into this, who have an increasing aging population. So they are very concerned that at the upper end, they do not have enough younger people who can carry forth innovation in various sectors of the labor market, and therefore invite and make it more easier for international students at the doctoral or postdoctoral level to come to the country and then have possibilities where they hopefully remain and stay and work in various sectors of society, specifically in science and engineering. So you have, therefore, happening in countries like you can take Germany or the Netherlands, which traditionally have been not, or even France, so open to allow people to work after education, loosening their immigration policies. Mm-hmm. So that also is, and that then has an impact also on doctoral education, because now around the world, countries looking for the best minds everywhere. So there is nearly a competition for the best students who hopefully then may also stay. In addition, you have a competition worldwide now who is becoming the best universities, and you know there are various kinds of ranking, one which in the recent years have become well known is the Shanghai Jiangtong University World Class Ranking. And I would really advise people to look on what kinds of measures they use. Another one which has become known is the London Times Educational Supplement Ranking, also of university. But specifically the former one I mentioned, the Shanghai Jiangtong University, which then comes up the top 100 world-class universities. And then that's where I come back to my initial points. Then governments see, oh, my universities in my countries do not rank in the top 100 universities. It's mainly American universities. It's others we can imagine, Oxford, Cambridge, University of Tokyo, you know, a few. So many governments then have as a goal to have at least one university first in the top 200 or 150 and then come in the top 100. So I sometimes have to smile and really laugh when I read governmental reports or hear them talking, because I feel like the top 100 needs to be stretched to have place for all these universities being in the top 100. So that comes in addition. Now, these ambitions by universities then filters down as pressure to ambitions by governments. Filters down as pressures to the university and also get more Nobel laureates, become well known. So what happens also in addition, European countries, and we may need to talk then also about the Bologna Agreement and the whole treaty where Europe and now there are 49 countries pulled together, indeed very explicitly to become a competition to the U.S. in terms of innovation in and science and research. And I kind of lost the thread a little bit. And and have established programs to bring even further excellence to their universities, because they're seeing in the top 100, and all is the U.S. is a leader, and they're seeing that in the U.S. universities have certain elite universities with a lot of money, often looked at private MIT, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and so on, And so what country have established, in addition to come to excellence, which then is associated with innovation and bringing economic growth and innovation in sectors, giving money to so-called excellence program and bringing back often expats with very high salary and very good condition to their country to create centers of excellence, which then are supposed to attract very good minds, doctoral students, postdocs, and so on. So you have these movements going on around the world. They are as well in Malaysia, as in Singapore, as in Qatar, as in now South Africa. It's literally around the world. And so what I have done starting really since 2000, I have been invited a lot around the world to countries and meetings to talk about my earlier research about the career paths of PhDs. Then I realized that we see kind of converging trends what countries are doing in doctoral education. And so since 2005, I convened every other year a group of experts in doctoral education. If a country has graduate deans, then there would be graduate deans, but also funders, so national research councils, researchers, or also people from governments, because often they're centralized units, to think and talk about what's going on in doctoral education and how much has the phenomena globalization had an impact on it. And that's how I come to understand how it works and what pushes it. That on the one hand, what we see, doctoral education has become more the same, more standardized around the world, which allows for greater mobility. But of course, always one movement has another side. That means also some cultural and differences, some are going away. Mm. What you also have now, that doctoral education is offered in English, because otherwise why would someone move to a country when you need to learn Chinese, Japanese, Swahili, so on, Norwegian, small language. So people can come and one can interact and can attract students. So that's one trend. Now, in addition, countries and universities have understood that the current labor market is such that regardless where you are, not just in academia, but in industry, in R&D, in as higher level professionals where PhDs people go, they will be often sent to another country because it's our U.S. companies who multinationalized and have branches all around the world. Mm-hmm. So they are, you know, professionals will be going too. So what you have nowadays, that PhDs particular not only need to know their academic skills, critical thinking, research methods, so on, you know, and a deep knowledge in one and at least one field. Subfield, but also professional skills. And this comes very much in this sense, I emphasize translational skills, which means that you not only can translate what you learn in academia to other sectors, but also then come off the research you're doing to apply them to societal needs that may be a product, but that may be in the health field to really patients' care. You know, it depends on what field. So this is a new set. So we're talking a lot about professional development, which doctoral students need, that they need to be able to convey complicated messages to lay audiences and so on, and have translations, all what comes with it. Now, in addition, because, as I said, they may be sent to other countries, and also in doing nowadays, in solving societal problems, be they health, energy, climate, poverty reduction, high tech work, they need to be able to communicate with people from around the world, because expertise is everywhere. Not one country has the monopoly on being a leader in everything. But, you know, the U.S. is on many good, but others too. So we need to train our current people also to interact with people from other cultures who do research, who do applications. So our doctoral students also need to have intercultural competencies. So given what has happened on the macro level, that's why I explained innovation, the hope for economic growth, looking for a labor force if a country has not enough, but also sending their own companies and work elsewhere. In the micro level, then in the classroom, in the doctoral studies, we need these skills. So you see how this is the intertwining of globalization's its effect on higher education, specifically on doctoral education, and then how universities and doctoral program need to adjust to it.
So had so many interesting opportunities here for me to ask further questions. Let me just very quickly, for anybody who has tuned in, reintroduce our guest, Maresi Naran. She's director of the Center for Innovation and Research in Graduate Education. That's at the University of Washington.
In Seattle.
In Seattle, yeah. Washington State, not Washington, D.C., the other side. And she's here spending some time on the campus to speak as part of the 2011 Symposium on Graduate Education, and this subject that she's been talking about, that is, you know, how one prepares graduate students to work in an increasingly globalized world. And she'll be giving a talk at the Illini Union tomorrow afternoon at 1, and I am expecting that anyone who is interested in hearing her should feel welcome to stop by. And questions here are welcome too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just to pick one thing here to start with, within higher education, I suppose, as we are in a lot of other things, we have become obsessed with this idea of ranking. And here, for example, in the United States, there are many people who rank universities. And of course, there's a lot of struggle and battle between universities because you want your university to be well ranked. And if it's not, you want to say, well, you're obviously ignoring us and we're doing very good things here and we ought to be in the list. I'm interested in this notion that, though, depending upon the criteria that you select to do your ranking, well, you one set of criteria maybe give you one list of universities and another set gives you another list. But whatever the dominant set of ranking is, then however things are done at those universities, then other universities will look at them and say, well, we want to be on the list, so I guess that we should do it that way. And whether that, in fact, does limit the product, if you consider the product to be the person with the PhD, and whether or not that maybe might not be such a good thing.
Yes, I agree with you. That is often not a good thing. And fortunately, there are many factors, and a doctoral education in the U.S. is very decentralized. Even if a college dean may want to end up at the next National Research Council, which does in the U.S. the assessment of doctoral program, which shouldn't be ranked, but everybody afterwards ranks itself, and it just came out last year, likes then to have different criteria, so they come up very high in the quartiles of good programs. Still on the ground level, it's very much in the program, in the department, the professors and the doctoral students, which make up, and the graduate school, which makes up the experience. While what you say is the case, I'm saying it does have some influence, but not so much, luckily. What I say about ranking, I like very much to differentiate between benchmarking and ranking. I think every institution or even program shall indeed compare itself to others on indicators, and often you do it on measurable indicators. That means how many complete, how long is the time to degree, how many have prestigious fellowships, and what, you know, complete and have jobs afterwards, and understand that now, since quite a while, and actually always has been in doctoral education, not everybody is becoming a professor nor wants to become a professor. So we need to look at other sectors where PhDs are employed and very happily employed, which my past research shows. So then employment, you know, that would be one factor. Then increasingly we need to also look what's the experience of doctoral students. So in this we can indeed benchmark or what the proportion of women and student of colors among them. Are we making an effort to be inclusive? So these can be criteria where I would say we shall compare each other to comparable universities. So that's why I think it's very good to compare in order to strive to improvement. But if we just rank in order to be the best, it doesn't make much sense because each institution has, as you pointed out, often a slightly different mission and each program a slightly different direction. There may be one program in engineering which is really there to train professionals, say to, let's take developmental or let's say engineering. No, I'm just environmental engineering, where they really train students, so going to developing countries to install sanitations better. So it's quite a different, that's a mission, and they may be very good in that, but comparing that to some who only try to be at the cutting edge of bioengineering, it's not useful. Yeah. So that's why I think we need to be careful what we measure.
Yeah. Maybe I would just, since you touch on it, before we got going, you asked what I'd be asking about some of your research on the life course of people with PhDs. And I said, well, I wanted to talk about this international thing, and I do. But since you touch on it, I guess I feel like I would want to ask a question, since you have done some longitudinal work looking at people who got PhDs, whether in fact the majority of people who got them say, if you said to them, if you had it to do all over again, would you? Most people say, yes.
Yes.
Yes, I would.
Yes.
And they feel satisfied, they're doing important work, and that the whole, and of course it's a lot of work, it's a big time commitment, it's a big sacrifice, it's hard. Getting a PhD is hard and should be. That people who have gone through that process would say, yes, in fact, I'm happy with where I am.
That's correct. What need to be seen is in certain fields, and then I would say in humanities and some social science, it takes after the PhD maybe up to 4 years that they're in more permanent position. And that insecurity where they're in year-to-year employment, that is hard. Mm-hmm. We have actually very similar situation in the science, not so much in engineering, only 10%, and that means those who do postdocs. Postdocs are temporary position, and they're not permanent. But postdocs has often a better status than being a visiting professor or lecturer. So we have to see, and that's why I also plea for doing career path studies and analysis in a longer age, because on the average, it takes 75% of all PhDs, if we take regardless what field, after 4 years are in permanent employment. And then kicks in that actually those who are outside universities are as satisfied with the job as those who are professors. Mm. And that's very interesting. Often our colleagues, my colleagues in academia, may not always believe it. But it's the case. And of course, there is a variation also what type of higher education institution there are. But there is a very high satisfaction also being employed outside.
Let me ask you a question. I have one that has come in on email. Someone, obviously, a question is prompted by some of the things that you've said. And the person writes there that Chris Hedges and others have put forth the idea that our institutions are producing highly specialized technicians rather than highly educated critical thinkers. And the listener wanted to know, can you give us your most critical views of the lack of critical thinking in higher education? And she's thinking critically at this moment.
Yes.
is the question clear, do you think, what the person
yes,
is getting at?
Yes, I think it's clear, but I think it's one of these general questions which is really hard to answer because we have so many different discipline approaches, people, and I think it doesn't help us much if we generalize and saying, you know, now people come out and are technicians and not critical thinker. There is a tendency, because of the push to publications and also because of a lot of high pressure of accountability, to do research which you know that it has a so-called positive outcome. And you may say this inhibits critical thinking. There is a tendency there. But overall, I think most professors and we, and since in the U.S. and now elsewhere too, it's not just one, but you have a dissertation committee. Together, you're a team. You try to assure that the outcome is also someone who can critically think.
All right. Well, we have somebody here who's on the telephone. We'll try them on line 4, calling from Piatone. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I find it really interesting nowadays. I know people, myself, I only have an associate, so I'm lacking in the PhD department, but with all the knowledge I have, I might as well have one, but without having certified. But I find it odd in this country that we're not, there isn't more people with PhDs and more engineering PhDs especially. I know with the cutbacks in NASA, it used to be when I was growing up, everybody wanted to be on that space shuttle, or everybody wanted to be the next astronaut to work on something, or you know, anything to do with aeronautical engineering. Now it seems like there's lacking, and what I see, here's what some of my friends, I got two friends that have two PhDs and they can't find a job, and I think what's happening is that the pay scale has been backed off a bit, and so people aren't as interested to spend all the time and the money on getting a PhD, especially if you don't think you're going to make, you know, that great a income. I'm just wondering if you heard that, and if that's the reason why we're lacking in that department or not. And I'll get off. Thank you.
Engineering has indeed recently. It was in certain areas in engineering more difficult for a PhD to find immediately jobs. That's correct. That's a matter when you think, where I come from, Boeing, you know, Boeing didn't get all the contracts. Now, just last week, it got a big one again. So engineers were laid off. Also engineers, PhDs, who are often group leader So that's one issue. It has actually picked up in the last year again. It's not in all PhD fields. If you go to bioengineering, anything in also the health science, there is a very high employment. So there is this fluctuations, but it's exactly in engineering where it's our U.S. companies who has taken many jobs to other countries. So that's it where, and the other trend that the research and development, which used to be in companies, it's largely reduced, and it's now asked that the universities do a lot of the company's R&D. So there are a lot more collaboration between industry and university, meaning, but also that industry has fewer R&D positions. So yes, we need to look at the big picture, but I can say that specifically the engineering PhD job market has picked up again.
Well, we are just a little bit past our midpoint in this hour of Focus. Marisa Narad is our guest. She's director of the Center for Innovation and Research in Graduate Education at the University of Washington at Seattle and is here spending some time on the campus. She'll be giving a talk as part of the Symposium on Graduate Education for 2011, talking overall about some of the challenges that people face here at colleges and universities as they prepare graduate students to work in an increasingly globalized world. And she'll be speaking tomorrow afternoon at 1, this is taking place at the Illini Union. So if you'd like to hear more from her, you can do that. And you can also call us, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, or send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. The fact is that, and as you discussed here at the beginning, that the market for PhDs in both in terms of where it is one goes to get your education and then where you go to work after is now becoming increasingly globalized. Universities like this one, I think, have depended fairly heavily on foreign students to make up their graduate student body. There are some, as the previous colleague suggested, there are some people who perhaps think that there's an issue here, or at least that we'd like to see more American students pursuing higher degrees, advanced degrees. But if we truly do end up having more of a global market for graduate education, and as you say, we have various countries around the world that are making a very deliberate effort to develop highly advanced studies of research and education, what does that mean for American universities?
Yes, there is. I think America need to wake up that it's not alone anymore in being far out the leader in higher education and considered the only place where everybody has the desire to come to. And that's sometimes painful to wake up to that. I would say still when we look at figures and numbers, still the U.S. is the place where the largest number of international students come to. But countries like Australia and the UK, and now increasingly more countries in Europe, and also Japan, now also starting, but China, to recruit heavily international students and offer them good opportunities. And in the U.S., the fees for international students are sometimes very high, although when you are at the doctor level and in science and engineering, you can work often on a person's project, and then you're a research assistant or so, or TA assistant, then your fees are covered. Now, so that's one, the awakening that there are others out there which are also very interested and looking to and making their educational system available and attractive. Second is what has to be understood that in the U.S., just engineering, as the caller before talked about, when the job market is very high, if you take all the Silicon Valley and early 90s, American students went after the bachelor to largest degree immediately in the market because you could get jobs with 60,000, 70,000, even up to 80,000 beginning salary. So why putting all that labor and getting a PhD? At that time, universities, like any organization, doesn't like to shrink. Departments don't like to shrink. So then they admitted more international students in order to have the same large department. So we have, in certain engineering fields, a very large proportion of U.S. students, also in mathematics and in economics, like specifically macroeconomics, in U.S. universities as a matter. Now where we have a recession, more American students, traditionally that's always the case, wait out the recession and go to graduate school. So we see actually an increase in American students now also in masters and doctorates. What we have then, I don't think the U.S. still needs in the technology and science fields, actually, all the forecast is saying needs really enough capability and capacity. So there is not a problem having too many international students here who may then want to stay. Mm-hmm. Actually, what's more an issue now, that their home country makes all the efforts to attract them back home. We have very good examples like Korea. The Korean government has made also since the late 90s a lot of effort to bring back Korean scholars who had here already faculty positions or were in industry and R&D to attract them back home. And many countries now doing that, Germany is one of them. France is one of them. These are one of those excellent initiatives I mentioned up front, where they now have special professorship position with a very high salary and very good working condition, where they try to attract the best who had been in the U.S. back home.
Well, you know, and I'm curious about something because the caller made reference to the cost of getting a PhD, and it can certainly be expensive. And we know that there are students who come out of their education with big debts. And, for example, if people going to med school may graduate from medical school with considerable debt. But having said all that, now I'm curious, how many people who get PhDs actually pay for them, you know, out of their own pocket?
Okay. This varies very much by disciplines. Mm-hmm. Medicine, which is a doctorate, an MD and not a PhD, but all the other doctorate studies in science and engineering function the way that the professors apply for research grants and then accept that many doctoral students for whom they have research assistance and money on the grants. So you practically can say that in science and engineering, no one really pays for their doctoral study. Mm-hmm. That's a different picture in social science, humanities, also some professional schools like mine in education. There, we more and more come to the mode that we try to admit to the doctoral level only people where we know we can fund them through a period of 5 years, and that we make all the efforts in terms of fundraising our colleges and development to have scholarships or also have teaching assistantships, so we patch together a funding packet that's at least 5 year long.
We are coming into about our last 10 minutes in this hour. Again, our guest is Marezi Narad. She is director of the Center for Innovation and Research in Graduate Education at University of Washington, Seattle, and visiting the campus here to talk about issues of preparing grad students to work in an increasingly globalized world. And she'll be giving a talk about this tomorrow afternoon at 1 on the campus. So again, people who are around Champaign-Urbana can stop by and hear her. Also on the program, if you have questions, you can call us. Something else you said that I thought was really interesting is that the notion that beyond preparing the student to work in their field and having them spend time in the classroom reading and learning and doing research on whatever it is that they do, because you're preparing people to work in this globalized market, so they may well be end up finding themselves living and working in a country that they did not grow up in, that part of graduate education now has to be graduate education in some way has to address that. And you have to work to develop and foster individuals' ability to go into a different culture and absorb it and become part of it and learn how to work there. And it strikes me that that was something that maybe not all that long ago, it just wasn't on the agenda. That wasn't part of the thing that you thought you needed to do for students, but that now that you do. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about how it is that people who are involved in graduate education are trying to address that need.
Yes, yes. And that will be very much examples I will give tomorrow. What is wonderful about it that our national agencies, such as the National Science Foundation, National Institute of Health, many also of private foundations have recognized the need and have established programs. I mentioned one by the National Science Foundation, the PIA program. It stands for Program in International Research and Education, which is large grants over nearly 3 million, where a group of interdisciplinary faculty can apply and design a whole doctoral study, which is largely problem-oriented, which is now also what I didn't say. In the meantime, how knowledge is produced has really changed. It's not anymore the individual professor with one student and one discipline. We realize that in order to solve societal problems, we need teams, and they need to come from different disciplines. So this particular, and also there are experts outside our national borders. So this particular program, as I mentioned as an example, is so one designs a doctoral study around a theme, let's say, for example, urban ecology or... I do some, our center does evaluation, so I'm thinking of astrobiology, something. But urban ecology is a good one, where you design that components is that your doctoral students also collaborate and go to another city and study how they study urban ecology, and there the people come in. So, for example, one example was at the University of Washington. That program had built-in components and working with Berlin University, another big urban city, working with Krakow, working with Mexico City. So the students in the doctoral studies get exposed, A, how other countries think about urban ecology. For example, the Seattle student learned, wow, you know, in Germany, they think so much historical, a whole different idea about urban planning than we do. In Mexico, you know, it's again different, a chaos. They also get to interact with doctoral students from other countries. And the best is what we also learned is if they are in a neutral field, not when the U.S. are in Germany or the German in the U.S., one is very sensitive, but say if both of them go to Poland or to Mexico City, where both are kind of foreigners, one learns to interact and values one cultures. And these are programs which really help to do that. Mm-hmm. There are other methods like having big, also NSF funds, but many other countries and have that, having summer institutes around a theme where doctoral students apply and go to. Norway offers a lot of those nearly everywhere in the world now. Then individually, faculty often have, in some fields, you have to be, if you study geology, geophysics, something, study the Antarctic, you automatically need to go to another country. So there was always collaboration. But in addition, faculty have collaborated with other countries. Now they make sure that their students also go there, go to the other lab. Now, even I'm, who is in a higher education, a social science, is not a field where we have a lab, I'm seeing that my students go and do like an intern or a visit and interact with universities I collaborate. This happens to be in South Africa, happened to be in Malaysia, happened to be in Germany. So we are trying to create smaller or bigger components to do that. And one big component, I will argue also in my lecture, I think each university, each research university is actually an international village. We have so many international visitors, scholars, international students, which are experts in their field, in their country, and we need to make better integrate and, in the positive sense, use of them. And there we can actually learn right here at home and become an international person and scholar before we go elsewhere.
Well, we're coming down to the point here. We have just a couple of minutes left. And one thing that strikes me is that, here, you know, for a long time, I think it has been fairly common for someone embarking on an academic career to get their undergraduate degree at one university, and then they get their PhD at another university, and they maybe might do a little postdoc research, something else, and then they'll get their first university job, and then maybe they'll go someplace else. But to do that all within the boundaries of the United States. Whether it is likely in the future that for graduate students here and elsewhere, that you might well see the normal course being that one, you might get your undergraduate degree in one country. You might get your PhD in another country. You might then go on to a teaching job in yet another country. So that the idea of the normal course that an academic life takes, it is becoming globalized, and that may well become more common for people to, in fact, have the mobility on that level.
You are very correct. That's happening for most countries outside the U.S. already.
Yes.
Well, for U.S., I would say that still only a minority change to another country for their doctoral study. They would still do this here. Some do. But for the postdoc, we see more and more that they do go to another country, or also in their early career, they go and spend a year elsewhere. And in fact, which has always been the case, when your promotion for a full professor, that you have an international reputation. Also, it means you go more and more also and collaborate with people around the world, because you need to know what's also the state of the art in your field. Now, that seems to be pushed on earlier on. So NSF and I just was organizing for them a workshop also about international collaborations. How do they work? We see more joint and dual degrees. But also we're asking, are there any hurdles specifically for women and students of color or people of color who traditionally didn't dare seeking now? I mean, anyway, it was expensive to get a higher and advanced education, now even go to another country. Is that a hurdle? What can we do? So there are efforts. And yes, you are right, that will be the future trends. And therefore, we need to look, how can we make sure that we're inclusive?
We're real short on time, but we do have a caller here. I want to try to get them in here. And Muhammad, line one, hello.
Yes, I would like to say that you, the questioner, do an absolutely excellent job, and I would like to commend you.
Well, I thank you. You don't have to agree, Professor Nuren. We're just about at the point here where we're going to have to finish. And I do, again, want to mention that for people who are listening to us who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, people who are involved in the university and in the community, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Marezi Nirad, she'll be giving a talk tomorrow afternoon at 1. This is at the Illini Union. Is part of the Symposium on Graduate Education for 2011, talking about many of these issues. And she'll be speaking Illini Union Rooms B and C tomorrow afternoon at 1. And again, I think anybody who is interested in attending should do that. So we've covered a lot of ground fairly quickly here. What sort of idea here would you like to leave with people?
That indeed, we need to look outward. The U.S. need to look outward and need to not be afraid that the world outside is so negative about the U.S. and hates it. There were sometimes often the fear, oh, my God, we are not liked outside. People around the world distinguish very much between politics and people. And I think the U.S. also needs to wake up, because if we don't look outward and move also outward and familiarize ourselves, the rest of the world does it. And indeed, they the mobility which other countries and other people have shown is really an advantage in the current and future labor market. And that's something we want as educational institution to make sure that our next generation doesn't fall in a disadvantage. Yeah.
Well, there we'll have to finish. I would also mention that if you're interested in perhaps finding out something about what the folks there at the Center for Innovation and Research in Graduate Education at Washington is all about, you can look them up on their website and find out about some of their research that you've been going on, some of the conferences and so forth that you've been involved in, and some of the writing on the subject you've done. And for people who are in the area, again, tomorrow afternoon at 1 at the Illini Union, our guest Marisa Inrod will be speaking. Thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome.